Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hi there. I'm Rand Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED. Hey there, everyone. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. And today on The Breakdown, we're going to talk to one of this year's new state lawmakers, someone who spent years advocating on behalf of the LGBTQ community, environmental causes, and more. Now he's on the inside up in Sacramento.
That's right. We're thrilled to have Assemblymember Rick Sabur with us. He represents a Southern California district that includes big cities like Santa Monica, West Hollywood, and Beverly Hills. But first, we are going to talk to CalMatters reporter Ben Christopher about a few stories he's been working on. Hey, Ben.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. So our listeners may have heard, like, on social media of this trend of Nepo babies. This kind of started, I think, in Hollywood and the entertainment space, this idea that there's a lot of nepotism. And you decided to see how that applies to the state capitol. What'd you find?
Yeah, I took a little spin on that topic, looking at the state legislature. And I found that 10% of state lawmakers are related by blood to either current legislators or former
legislators. Sitting right now, 10%.
Sitting right now. And that number just kind of jumped out at me, and I wanted to look into sort of the why and the how of it. How is it that someone decides to run for office, to take their father's place, or to join their sister, or to join their husband? And what that means for state politics.
And so there was a graph as part of your story that showed it going up over the years. It kind of goes up and down, but generally the trend is up. Like, what accounts for that? Because I was thinking, like, term limits has something to do with that. There's just more seats opening up because people are forced out or into another, you know, another office of some kind.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good question. I'm not sure there's a single answer, but I think term limits has a lot to do with it. You see, there's sort of a gradual inching up of the number of lawmakers in the legislature who have these sort of blood ties to current or former lawmakers going up throughout the 20th century. But then you see it really kind of spike up after the 1990s when term limits were enacted in California. And I think that is part of it. You had a generation of lawmakers who were leaving and we're looking for people to take their place. And hey, maybe we look to our son or our brother or our cousin.
Well, and obviously a lot of those people have exposure to politics, so it's not shocking they would be interested. They also have something that's like, you know, mana in politics, which is name ID. I'm curious, though, did you find anything nefarious or beneficial? Like, are these folks better equipped to do this job, or is there something shady about, you know, a Brian Daly and a Megan Daly who are married and are serving in each house of the legislature?
Well, certainly if you talk to the legislators themselves, there's nothing shady about it. Exactly. And you could point to a lot of positives, you know, legitimately. With the introduction of term limits, you have some people argue that there was sort of a collapse of what you might call institutional memory. Mm-hmm. Like, there
are give
these
the lobbyists a lot of power. Yeah.
Give the lobbyists a lot of power, give staff a lot of power.
Maybe journalists.
Maybe journalists a lot of power. And so when in comes the son of a former legislator, you know, that they grew up with the knee of that lawmaker, they know how the chamber works to a certain extent. And so it's a way to sort of transmit that institutional knowledge.
And it's not just the state legislature, we should say. Congress has its share of family members. Doris Matsui, who represents Sacramento in Congress, her husband died and many years ago, Bob Matsui, and she's there. Lois Capps took the place of her husband mm-hmm. when he died. So, and here in San Francisco, and here in San Francisco, we've got Nancy Pelosi, who one of these days is going to not run for re-election. Her daughter, Christine, is rumored to be thinking about that. Mm-hmm. And they, in addition to all these other things, they kind of inherit this political infrastructure, consultants and donors and all that stuff. So it kind of makes sense.
That's right. I mean, there are a lot of industries in which who you know matters, and certainly politics is one of them. Look at the Browns, right? Jerry mm-hmm. Brown, his sister, his father, all politicians, successful or otherwise. And I think there is, you know, going back to this name ID aspect to it, especially at the legislative level where, you know, people listening to this, notwithstanding, a lot of people don't know who their state lawmaker is.
Totally.
You look at your ballot, there are a bunch of anonymous names, and then you see one, you think, oh, yeah, Cortese, that sounds familiar. I think I've seen that before. And that often is enough to make the difference.
Name ID is worth
a
lot of money.
Which is a little depressing. All right. Well, I want to switch gears because the other thing you've been keeping an eye on is this oil special session. It has not been that special. The governor called for it in the fall amid just horrific soaring oil prices, right? And we had the first real hearing on this in the Senate a few weeks ago. A lot of skepticism, even from Democrats, about the idea of a penalty on windfall profits. I want to push you on something else, though. You know, I thought the most interesting thing of the hearing was how little the experts know about why oil prices are where they are.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as if the governor may not get his penalty. We'll see. But what did you think about that part of things? Like Siva Gunda, the energy commissioner president, was basically saying, regardless of what you do on that, we need more information.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. If there was any kind of consensus at last month's hearing, it was the idea that it would be nice to know a little bit more about this market. You know, contrasted to some of the other big energy markets in the state, electricity certainly, even natural gas, there's just so much more understanding by regulators of how these markets work. The oil and gas market seems to be a bit more of a black box. And so that's not maybe very satisfying for Newsom. He really wanted to come out swinging and stick it to big oil. This might result in just more fact-finding, but that does seem to be where the appetite is.
Gas prices have come down a lot since this was big issue. And, of course, Newsom was running for re-election at that time as well. Do you get the sense that the appetite for doing something is less and or fear of sort of the law of unintended consequences where, you know, you try to do something to fix one problem and then you create another problem?
Yeah, I think the answer to both questions is yes. Certainly the urgency is not there, certainly where it was back in the fall when drivers were paying so much at the pump. And given all the uncertainty about how this market works, you heard a lot of skepticism, not just from Republicans, which you'd expect, but a lot of Democrats saying, well, what happens if we slap this new penalty or tax or whatever you want to call it on refiners? Would that do what we want it to do? And what would the unintended consequences be?
I mean, the interesting thing is what Newsom and a lot of folks who are, you know, pushing this penalty would say is, it already had an effect. Just him saying it, you know, oil prices did drop pretty quickly after that. It's really hard to know whether,
right,
or gas prices, I should say. Oil prices were falling already when we were still seeing these wild fluctuations. But, you know, Scott, to me, this brings up a sort of pattern we've seen out of this governor, which dates back to really when he was mayor here, which is he has this proclivity for wide, sweeping announcements, pronouncements, and he doesn't always check in with staff. We saw another one this week.
Yeah, and that was Walgreens. He just tweeted on Monday that we're done doing business with Walgreens because they're not going to allow distribution of the drug mifepristone, mm-hmm, which induces abortion in states where that's restricted. They kind of caved.
Or some states where it's not totally restricted.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, they caved into a lawsuit, several lawsuits actually, but Republican attorneys general around the country are suing to block the distribution of this drug. And, you know, the state health department had, Health and Human Services had, I don't think, any knowledge that he was going to do this. They didn't know. They just kept referring us back to the governor's office. He did something similar with a tweet over guns and abortion with Texas, then the state's U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of makes you wonder if this is really the best way to govern, governing by tweet,
yeah,
a little bit.
But I guess on the other hand, I mean, Ben, what do you think? Because some of this is just Newsom standing up and beating his chest the same way DeSantis does or Abbott, you know, Greg Abbott does, mm-hmm, governors of red states. Like, from where you're sitting watching these, you know, bigger policy debates, do you think there's frustration with Newsom or do you think that some people are just glad to see him kind of fighting back?
Well, probably a little bit of both. But I you know, as a journalist, it's not my role to feel sympathy for his comms team. But
no,
especially after the Walgreens tweet sent everyone in a flurry figuring, well, wait, what does that mean? What about Medi-Cal? What about all these contracts that the state has? It does create a certain amount of confusion. On the other hand, we're talking about it. It gets his name splashed across headlines, and it shows that he's sort of, you know, fighting the culture war fight on the left.
Yeah, and, you know, to your point, Marisa, I think Republicans seem to have no qualms whatsoever about, you know, kind of grandstanding on issues, maybe the merits be damned. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, you know, Democrats, for better or worse, tend to be more policy in the policy weeds a little bit sometimes, and it restricts them from
right.
doing that kind
like,
of thing.
Like, there wasn't necessarily a lot of like deep thinking about the legality of some of these, say, like the Don't Say Gay bill, right? Like, I mean, I think there's a push to just do it in a lot of red states.
Or the drag bill, you know, in Tennessee. I think that maybe even with the assumption that it's going to be struck down, but at least they get their name out there, they raise money off of it, they stir up the base, and, you know, all the rest of it.
And I do think, and I've said this before, that there is at least some flavor of the Democratic Party that's very happy to see someone like Newsom coming out strong, because we've seen a very different approach from someone, say, like Joe Biden historically, right? All right, we actually have to take a short break. Ben, thank you so much for coming
Thanks
in.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Ben Christopher of Cal Matters. Check out all his reporting at Cal Matters. We are going to take this short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Assemblymember Rick Zber. We spoke with him recently in our Sacramento Bureau. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest, and I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts, because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, here with Scott Schaefer. We are in our Sacramento Bureau today, and we are delighted to have with us a new member of the State Assembly, someone with a long history of activism on behalf of environmental issues, social justice, and the LGBTQ community. Rick Chavez Zber represents the 51st Assembly District in Southern California, which includes a lot of cities, Santa Monica, West Hollywood, Beverly Hills, and more. Rick, Assemblyman Zber, welcome to the breakdown.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. We wanted to start, like we often do, with your childhood. I know you, I think, were born in Utah, but then moved to rural New Mexico.
I was born in Albuquerque. And then we left for a period of time when I was really young, where my dad went to University of Utah for a graduate degree. Came out to China Lake. And worked at the naval base out there, and then moved back to Albuquerque and to this farm community when I was first in second grade to Albuquerque, and then fifth grade into the farm community where my mom grew up.
So what do you remember about Albuquerque?
I remember a lot. I remember a lot about the farm community, actually, which is really where I was from the time I was in fifth grade till high school. And, you know, that was just a really interesting place to grow up. Is where my mom's family was from. We moved back because my mom wanted to take care of her parents as they were getting older. And so we moved to this farm that was about a mile from my grandparents' farm where my mom grew up.
So you're all farming.
Our farm, the one that I grew up in, it was mostly alfalfa and oat pasture, and we had some garden vegetables. So we probably had a couple hundred acres. My grandfather had a dairy, so it was all cattle and other things.
You know. Yeah. And what was – I mean, I can imagine growing up on a farm being a lot of fun, also potentially a lot of work. I mean, what was it like to be a kid there?
A ton of work. I decided I never wanted to live on a farm as an adult.
What did they have you doing?
So, I mean, get up at, 5 in the morning to basically, make sure that the cattle had water and basically put hay over the fence so that they had something to eat for the day. And we had a – as I got older, because my dad and I used to do it when I was younger, and then – the responsibility shifted over to me as I got older in the morning. And then we had a farmhand that helped in the afternoon because I couldn't get back in time to do what we needed to do in the afternoon and evenings. And my parents thought school was more important than what I was doing on the farm.
So lucky you.
I was really lucky, yeah.
Well, tell us about your mom. She sounds like a really interesting person. She must be about 98.
She's 90. She turns 99 this Saturday.
I know recently you chose to take your mother's maiden name as part of your last name, Chavez. Talk about that decision and, I don't know, has it changed anything? Do you think people read you any differently now?
I think they do because it was always before... people never realized that I was half Latino.
Yeah.
And I think people sort of understand that now. But it was a big decision. My mom, always used to basically say, Rick, remember you're a Chavez. She always tells all of the kids that because she's very proud of, our heritage. And I think it's just really, I took it as a middle name, as a second middle name. And I think it just identifies, what is true about my upbringing. I mean, it's sort of in some ways the Chavez side was more influential in my upbringing than the Zabur side was. Yeah. We grew up in this farm community with my mom's family all around. And, my mom was making the typical, my dad learned to appreciate even more New Mexico food and cuisine. I mean, I remember coming home from high school every day and my mom had a big pot of red chili on the stove and beans. And that's what we ate every day with tortillas. I mean, it was a very New Mexican upbringing.
Yeah. So you, I think I read that you were accepted or offered a spot at West Point.
Yes.
The Army Academy there. And you decided not to go. Going to Yale, not a bad, backup plan B. But why did you decide not to go that route?
Well, I never wanted to go there. So what happened was, this little farm high school, this farm community high school, I mean, it was a school that I think there may have been out of 200 and 250 graduates in my high school, there may have been 8 to 10 of us that went to college at all. It really was not a college preparatory place. It's like most people stayed in the community, became farmers, and worked or had small businesses in the community. So going to college was really not the typical thing that most kids did. And my high school guidance counselor, she sort of knew that I wanted to go to college. And my visions were not going to an Ivy League school. It was really just going to college, period. My dad was
getting
really,
out of there.
Yeah. And my dad was really, he was a really big influence on that. He had been a high school dropout himself. And actually when he dropped out of high school, ended up going to work in the steel mills in Chicago and was sort of a union steel worker. And during the Korean conflict, he enlisted in the Air Force. And when he went, it was because he had to help support his family. His family was really poor on the south side of Chicago. And when he had the opportunities afforded by the GI Bill, he basically took those opportunities and went back and got his GED and went back to college and ultimately got a master's degree and a PhD and became a college professor. So he was always, school is the most important thing. Do well in school, all of that. Yeah.
So you end up going to Yale and then Harvard Law. Mm-hmm. Not bad for a kid from a farm in Albuquerque. I'm curious, when did you come out?
Coming out was not sort of the thing that happens like it does today because it was a slow process for me. It was the first person I ever told that I was gay was my sister who passed away. And then it was a, you know, then I think it was close friends and then the rest of my family. I would sort of say it started when I was the year after I got out of college. So I would have been, 23. And I think my dad never knew that I was gay. Yeah. I mean, he passed away before I told him. And by the time, and then really when I was completely out was when I ran for Congress. Actually, it was before I ran for Congress. I did this event for Barbara Boxer when I was still an associate at Latham & Watkins, mainly because at that point I was really focused on the AIDS crisis and the fact that the federal government was not doing anything. And so I became politically active mainly because I was trying to make sure that people that were helping address the AIDS crisis were getting elected to Congress and the Senate. And Barbara Boxer was someone that I, we were going to do this little house party for her at my house, and it turned and it was in it was billed as an event by the gay and lesbian community at the time, it just because no one had ever, I mean, there had been no one that had ever embraced our community before. This thing that was going to be, 100 people at my house turned into this eight or 900 people. And we had to move it to the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel, and Midge Costanza came. I mean, Barbara Boxer wasn't even coming to this event. This was just supposed to be a house party.
On her behalf to like raise
money.
And
then it just sort of got out all over the place. And the folks in my, I think there was a newspaper that covered it, and some folks in my high school, and Latham found out about it, and it just became just very, very well known.
That's one way to out yourself, I guess.
So I think you were the first openly gay partner at Latham Watkins, right?
That's the first openly gay lawyer and openly gay partner.
Which is crazy. It's now, just because, there's gay people in every profession. But was that, problematic in some way? I mean, was it something they were proud of? It sounds like you were not outed, but, you came out, because of something else you were doing, not because you decided you want to tell all your colleagues you were gay.
Yeah. I got to say, it was at a time when very few firms had openly gay lawyers and partners. The thing I'll say about Latham is that they're a meritocracy, and they responded to it in a way that I, in retrospect, that both at the time and in retrospect, I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
So you went on to run for Congress in 1996. You lost that. Spoiler alert, everyone. And then for 8 years, you were executive director of Equality California, which might be how a lot of people know your name, I think. I think I first talked to you. Can you just talk about that? I mean, to Scott's point, the pace of LGBT rights and the changes that have happened over the last two decades is really quick, I think, when you look at sort of the long arc of history. I mean, what do you think about the most from those 8 years? What are you most proud of the work you all did at Equality California?
I mean, I think when I came to Equality California, the organization was really identified with marriage equality, which is a really important milestone for the community. But we had just earned that as a community. And I think a lot of folks then thought, both some in our community and some outside of it, that the work was all done. Mm-hmm. And, what we all know is that LGBTQ people, when you look at all of the, measures of health and well-being, everything from rates of dropout in the school where LGBT kids are four times more likely to drop out of school, or rates of homelessness where 4 out of 10 homeless youth are LGBTQ, or rates of engagement with the criminal justice system, or rates of healthcare coverage, or rates of substance use. I mean, really, almost every measure of health and well-being, the LGBTQ community scores low. And if you're a member of our community who's also a member of a community of color, or an immigrant, or a person living with HIV, or even a woman, you're at the very bottom. And so what we did is we basically, I think, helped the broader community and our community itself to understand that, that we don't have full lived equality, even if we have certain civil rights protections, and that part of achieving that means having a very intersectional lens on how we look at things. And that means that advancing LGBTQ rights means that we actually have to look at labor rights and a good minimum wage and good working conditions and making sure that we're addressing gun violence and making sure that we're looking at health care coverage. And so the thing that I'm proud about is that we really did, I think, transform how we looked at moving our community ahead to looking at sort of the way that people live and the things we needed to do to support our community achieve what we call full lived equality.
You know, you mentioned, we talked about your run for Congress in 1996 against Steve Horn, what we would now call a moderate Republican, I guess. And, you know, just recently, Robert Garcia, the mayor, openly gay, Latino mayor of Long Beach, got elected to that area in Congress. It seems to be on a fast track to leadership in Congress and a rising star in the party. We have, you know, openly gay folks representing parts of the Inland Empire, red parts of Riverside County. What do you make of that?
I think people understand that, you know, LGBTQ people were people, and we basically, you know, face the same kinds of challenges that everyone else does, and we have the same interests that everyone else does. And frankly, you know, I think some of it also too is the fact that, you know, the LGBTQ community, we've spent a lot of time really building leadership within the community, making sure that we're supporting people at, you know, lower levels and helping them learn how to be good public servants. And then the public, you know, as you mentioned at the opening of the show, I think the way people think about our community is really different than it was when I ran, you know, in 1996. I mean, when I ran that year, every single article about my race started out with, you know, Rick Zabur, an openly gay man, mm-hmm. comma, blah, 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 blah. I mean, that was not, I don't think there was a single article about my race, other than maybe in the LGBTQ press, but article that was generally in my race where, you know, that was
incidental.
I don't know. I think the LGBTQ press likes to call that out too, actually.
They do. They do. But, you know, the LA Times, the press in the district, I mean, that was not the key notable thing.
Do you think
thing.
It was a liability for you then?
Back in
96?
No, actually, I think it was back in those days, because it was so novel, I actually think it gave me a bit of a better chance than it might have had I not been gay, because it was just, there was so much national attention on that race at the time. But I do think that it is something that is a challenge and an obstacle that many candidates still have to overcome. When you look at Todd Gloria's race when he was running for mayor of San Diego, you still had people using, you know, really homophobic tropes against him based on some, you know, mischaracterizations of bills that he voted for that were sponsored by Equality California here in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And we still have folks that, you know, that mischaracterize our bills. And, you know, there was an article about me that was in the Washington Beacon just a few weeks ago that was basically characterizing a bill that I am sponsoring this year that is about helping teachers understand how to identify and provide support for LGBTQ kids in the schools was characterized as a bill that I was trying to help teachers help kids get sex change operations without right. their parents' support.
Yeah. Well, it's like there's a new sort of wave of this grooming civil rights, yeah. right, mm-hmm. with around the attacks on trans kids, the yeah. sort of whole grooming trope. Why run again? I know your sister Jackie, who you mentioned, who passed away of ALS, encouraged you to take this on again. You know, it's hard to run for office. Why did you want to run for the assembly, and what do you want to accomplish?
Well, so my sister was really the person who, you know, encouraged me to do it. I mean, she passed away in 2020, September, after a couple year battle with ALS. And she, you know, turned to me one day about 9 months before she passed away. And she said, you know, Rick, I'm looking at my life and I have a lot of regrets about the things that I didn't do. And she said, you know, when I look at you, you were supposed to do something in public service. And she said, it's not too late for you. You're in your 60s. It's not too late. I hope you will think about figuring out, you know, you don't have all the time in the world, but you've got enough time to have an impact.
Yeah. Well, we gotta wrap up here, but I do want to ask, you mentioned your children. I know you have a son and I think twin daughters.
Twins, one, a boy and a girl, and then a daughter who's in college.
Okay. What do they think about all of this? And what advice have they given you?
So they think different things. one of my daughters is really, really, I think both of the twins are really into the fact that, you know, lots of questions about what I do every week. They're very politically focused. You know, the twins were the two that right after Trump was elected came home one day. And when I came home one day, they basically asked why we weren't protesting that weekend, basically. So we said, do you want to go protest? And they said, yes, we wanted to go protest. And then they created these signs about Trump, which I won't describe what they said because it's not appropriate for the radio show. But and I had to tell them that that we still had to respect the president and that the signs weren't all that appropriate. And now I look back at it and think that they may have been
ahead of the curve.
They've been more right about things than I knew at the time. But then my other daughter is actually really, I think, really proud. She's actually in college now and is a theater kid, just graduated from LOXA, the High School for the Arts. Downtown and is very artistic, but off in college in her first year. So
that's great.
Well,
Assemblyman Rick Chavez-Barre, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's really nice to see you both.
And that's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We are a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineer is Jim Bennett, and our producer is Guy Marzorati. I'm Scott Schaefer. Find more of KQED's politics coverage by subscribing to our Political Breakdown newsletter. You'll find it at kqed.org/newsletters.
I'm Marisa Lagos. We'll see you next time.
Do you love learning about the San Francisco Bay Area, its history, its people, its unique blend of cultures? Then you should check out the Bay Curious book. I'm Katrina Schwartz, editor and producer on the Bay Curious podcast, and I'm here to let you know that for the month of May, we've worked out a sweet deal for KQED podcast listeners. Right now, you can get the Bay Curious ebook for $1.99. That's right, $1.99. Just search for Bay Curious wherever you get your ebooks or find a link in our show notes. This offer does expire at the end of the month, though, so you'll want to act on it fast. Happy reading!
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay Curious, Mindshift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.